Welcome to Finding Proof, where we discuss all things early stage VC.
We're your hosts, Thanasis and Jenny of the Proof Fund, and our goal is to get to know the best seed and early stage VCs out there. Today, we're joined by Liza Benson, partner at Modern Ventures. Modern is an early stage venture fund focused on technology companies that are innovating within the real estate, mortgage, finance, insurance, hospitality, and home services space. They focus on North American investments. So Liza, thank you so much for joining us today. We're really excited to learn more about you and Modern Ventures. And as a starting point, why don't you tell us a little bit about the fund and your overall strategy?
Yeah, thank you, Jennifer. Really glad to be here. So Modern Ventures, we're an early stage venture investor in real estate, home services, fintech, and insurtech industries having to do with real estate. When we talk about real estate, we mean multifamily, which means residential rental apartments, commercial, and residential. So those are the three verticals that we really focus on. We are different from your typical venture capital fund in the sense that our limited partner base is mostly strategic. Mm-hmm. So we have large multifamily operators who are often REITs as investors. We have large residential real estate brokerages as investors. We have large commercial brokerages as investors. And everything that we do has a dual purpose. Obviously, a financial return. We want to do well for the fund. But secondarily, and just as important, in fact, is a benefit channel, something within the industry where we can help, we can affect our returns, we can stack the deck for that company.
Right.
Fundamentally, these huge companies that invest in us, we have, in fact, some of the largest multifamily operators in the world as investors. Even if we did 10x, unfortunately, we wouldn't be that impactful on their balance sheet, but we are very impactful to their businesses. When you're a REIT that trades at 40 or 50 times earnings, $1 million of net operating income we can deliver is an unbelievable return for them. So we really think about things in terms of helping our industry and partners, which kind of creates a symbiotic relationship with our portfolio companies.
Yeah, and I'd imagine so. And as I understand, real estate currently accounts for 20% of US GDP, but actually only 5% of VC capital is deployed within that particular sector. Why is that?
I think you're even counting SoftBank in that. So, I mean, it's probably even less than that if you took out some really, really big SoftBank investments.
Right.
I've often compared the real estate industry, and I hope they don't take this offensively, to cable before Netflix. That's kind of where we are in the timeline of technology adoption by the real estate industry. As a venture capitalist, I see that as a huge greenfield and a huge opportunity. You're fundamentally dealing with an industry that's been so profitable. They didn't necessarily have to embrace technology as part of their businesses. I think what we've seen over the last 5 to 10 years from WeWork to everything else is that the consumerization of real estate and the demands of the consumers of that real estate want it in the same format they're used to everything else, custom, instant, to their liking, and not as rigid as the real estate industry is today. We fundamentally think that COVID probably really accelerated things a lot because the more technology you have, the less people you have, the more automation you have, the less you are dependent on some of these outside factors that are happening. So I think the real estate industry is very much embracing change right now, and even more since COVID.
And with COVID, you have seen different tracks, I think, on residential and on commercial, right? Residential is faring better in some ways because people are coming out again and wanting to buy bigger homes, but commercial is suffering. So what is your sense of what's happening in the market with COVID?
Well, I think when commercial, obviously they suffered hugely in terms of office vacancies. I mean, especially I'm here in New York City and they've never seen commercial vacancy and retail vacancy rates like we're seeing today. But I think from the perspective of technology, it's actually an impetus. You don't want security guards checking people in. You need contactless delivery of people's lunches. You don't want them waiting in food courts. You need technology that's cleaning the air, cleaning your bathrooms, cleaning your HVAC systems. You want as much technology as possible to bring, first of all, the office to be safe as the number one priority to come back. And then secondarily, what enhancements can you make to encourage people that commercial office will come back? So I think that for us as investors, again, we see in the commercial real estate arena a lot of opportunity. In the residential, I think no one saw this coming fundamentally at the beginning of the pandemic, was that you'd had this unbelievable boom in single family residences where people were looking to get out of elevator type buildings. They were looking for backyards. And listen, we benefited from that hugely. Publicly, we just sold a company called HomeSnap to CoStar for $250 million. We have a company called Super in the home warranty space, which has just been booming. So our residential companies have certainly just seen huge tailwinds just because the market has been so hot.
And so you guys also have a 7-month accelerator program called Passport. Does the fund primarily invest in companies that are coming out of that accelerator program, or how does that work?
Yeah, so the way I describe it is that Passport, just to give a bit of background, is our sort of systematized business development effort. So we not only have a large array of LPs in the multifamily, residential, and commercial space, but we actually have about 700 advisors who are industry executives who are interested in bringing innovation into their corporations. So what we do is those 700 industry professionals interact with our Passport class to hopefully get deals, pipeline, and bring innovation into their organizations. We have 3 full-time staff whose job is to get deals and pilots and revenue for our accelerator companies. The way I would describe the accelerator is that every company that we invest in must go through the accelerator, but some of the companies that go through the accelerator, we do not invest in or invest in later.
Got it. So the fund sits over top of the accelerator, essentially.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay. And it's a due diligence period that you guys have, which is incredible, right?
The best. So generally, our investment criteria from a fund perspective is that we'd like to see a minimum of $2 million of revenue. However, if we have an earlier stage company that goes through Passport and we just see the acceptance by our partners, we may make a seed investment earlier on than we generally would, just because of that, you know, massive amount of due diligence where they've had 50 meetings with industry executives and we hear the feedback, they're getting deals. So yeah, for me as the head of investments, it really stands as the best due diligence tool you have is to watch them, to get to know them over time. So it's very, very helpful. And then for our companies that come into the accelerator and have our later stage, there's different goals, but it's a really stage agnostic program. In fact, a company of ours that just SPAC'd called Porch in December went through the program less than 2 years ago when they had 60 million plus of revenue. So it really is from the earliest stages to the later stages.
We've seen a significant increase in prop tech investing over the last kind of 5 to 7 years, I would say. What do you think is motivating a lot of the traditional industry players and your investors to participate? Is it like a defensive kind of posture of, I don't want to be disintermediated or changed by technology, or is it an offensive, gee, how can I make my business better?
Well, listen, I think what we always say to our investors and LPs is you don't want to have technology happen to you, all right? You don't want to be disintermediated. And I think fundamentally, if you even think about something like WeWork, which obviously has a big shadow in the industry, both positive and negative, what happened with WeWork is you had this disintermediation of the landlord and the tenant experience, right? So WeWork came in the middle and said, these tenants, they don't want these long-term leases. They don't want to build out of their spaces. They want it flexible. They want it fast. They want it with all these benefits that WeWork was able to provide. And fundamentally, obviously there's some big problems with WeWork's business model in terms of long-term leases and shorter term clients who could cancel their leases at any time. But I think that really woke up the industry in the sense that that's what the tenants, or i.e. their constituents, wanted, was wanted that flexibility, wanted that full build out, wanted all of those benefits that WeWork provided. So I think something like that in the industry is just very much awakening in terms of the fact you need to have a more consumer friendly experience in an industry fundamentally that hasn't had to in the past.
As a follow-up to that, is there a specific use case or thesis that you saw that you can give us as an example, in essence, one of your portfolio companies that you can tell us the story of to make these points?
Let me talk about that in terms of companies that we've looked at, how commercial landlords are thinking about some of these things. And I'll give you some examples of portfolio companies, but also things that we're looking at. So what's important about what WeWork did was just sort of app-based sort of reservation systems and, you know, the ability to have these short-term leases. And I think a lot of companies are trying to be the software layer there and not take on those long-term leases and to sell that software to the larger commercial real estate companies so they can, in fact, run their own like WeWork competitors. And I think that's certainly happening a lot in the industry. In terms of embracing change, I mean, we've had a company called Ritual, which is actually a later stage company that came into our Passport class last time. And what they do is contactless food delivery, right? And had primarily worked in the commercial office, which obviously had suffered a blow during the pandemic. But as commercial office comes back, the popularity of something like Ritual, where you don't want people waiting in food courts in lines, you don't want people running up and down the elevators to get food. You do want to offer this huge benefit of fee-free delivery. We're seeing a huge interest, even greater than they had before, in commercial operators offering that service. In addition, multifamily operators are interested in the service as well, because you now have all these people working from home where they don't want to pay high fees for delivery and are sick of cooking, right? So we've actually brought Ritual into multifamilies where they have drop points where you can get fee-free delivery at night or for lunch as a benefit of sort of being in that multifamily. So I think a lot of the pandemic issues have certainly caused changes in how people are operating.
What other themes or companies are you most excited about right now?
Yeah, no, absolutely. So one of the companies that I'd probably like to talk about that we just did recently is called Moto Refi. And what Moto Refi is doing is digitizing auto refinance. So auto refinance, if you probably bought your car, you probably, most people, 85% get a loan. You don't get a really great rate at the dealer, right? So basically, dealerships now make money more off of warranty and financing than they do actually the car. Just like Better Mortgage, which is another one of our portfolio companies that has hugely benefited in the last year or so, they have digitized home refinance. Moto Refi is digitizing auto refinance. So what Moto Refi is able to do is, for people who have already bought their cars, is match them with a lender with a much, much lower rate. And this is an area where only 2 to 3% of people actually do this today. And you might ask yourself, well, how does that fit into modern channels? Well, we, with our LPs, cover over 60% of the residential real estate transactions in the U.S., and with that, the almost 2 million real estate agents that exist who spend a lot of time in their cars. So with the associations, we are offering Moto Refi as a benefit for people to be able to lower their auto loans. As well, our multifamily operators are very interested in lowering people's payments for other things. And after your rent, your car loan is probably your number two expense. So we're actually offering it as well through our multifamily operators as something that can lower someone's overall expenses and obviously make your tenants very happy.
Yeah. And shifting gears a little bit, tell us about your background and how you got into venture.
Yeah, I've been in venture for actually well over 20 years. Mm-hmm. I started my career in investment banking, as most people do. And in the late 99 timeframe, was looking to move into either sort of private equity or venture. Ended up joining a fund that was part of Bear Stearns. Now that's going to date me. And in early 2000. And when I joined there, we had closed a $358 million fund in April of 2000. So that was pretty much the last month before the crash. And actually, it was an amazing time to start up in venture capital. And you say, well, that doesn't sound like an amazing time. It was an amazing time to learn, because I learned really what the documents mean.
And when Which things is always are going important.
All, it's always important. When things are going up and to the right, you don't really need to know about your anti-dilution rights. You don't really know need about your liquidation preference. You don't need to know about what rights you have with other investors. All those things don't really matter when things are going well. When they're going badly, they matter a lot.
Yeah, it's also a good time to invest. Our 2000 fund, I think, was probably the best fund we ever had, because everything is in the doldrums. Some companies continue to perform, right? And so you get to pick interesting companies at really attractive prices.
No, absolutely. And we had an existing portfolio that was, the original fund was 100 million. So there was like 20 companies in there. And there was a lot of restructuring to do in terms of like, who's going to live, who's going to die? Who do you want to refinance? Who are you going to do a down round on and do a pay to play cram down round and all that sort of stuff that no one talks about too much anymore. But I've certainly done tons of those in my career. And then in early 2002, Danish, just like you guys, we started really investing heavily. And that was a fabulous time to put money to work, because you had some really great companies at some fabulous valuations. That's something where there was real value in the market, which it's hard to believe today that actually existed at some point, but we could invest in companies at some really great valuations. So in the end, that 2000 vintage fund actually did quite well and was, in fact, had good returns and was top decile, because we were able to carefully work through that period and ended up actually staying with that group of people through the Bear Stearns JP Morgan transition. And then eventually we actually became Highbridge Principal Strategies Growth Equity Division. So it was with that team of people for over 14 years.
And having been in VC for the past 20 years, what are some of the ways that you've seen the industry change?
I mean, the proliferation of funds is just amazing, right? It's just unbelievable how many funds there are. And you know, that's one of the things that really attracted me to Modern. I mean, before Modern, I didn't have, I joined about 3 years ago, a ton of real estate experience. And I told that to the founder of Modern Constance. I said, what do you want? She said, no. I want someone who can lead due diligence in an institutionalized way. We look at so many different business models. Don't worry, we'll get the real estate stuff down for you. I really want more to institutionalize our processes. And what I was really attracted to was the fact that when at Modern, I almost call this a vertically integrated fund where our LPs and ourselves sort of work together to stack the deck for our companies. Mm-hmm. And this is not a situation where you call your LPs once a year at the annual meeting, you get in the report. I mean, we're talking to them on a weekly basis on what their needs are, what they think of our portfolio, how we can be helpful. And from the portfolio company perspective, I bring more than just cash to the table. I bring relationships, I bring channels, I bring revenue, I bring pilots, I bring feedback, I bring all these things. So the changes that I've seen in the VC industry have attracted me more to this verticalized model because I don't have to just compete on price. Mm-hmm. And if you're not Sequoia or Andreessen, and there's, you know, a couple hundred B2B SaaS funds in New York, it's hard to not compete on price.
Right.
And I think at Modern, we have a unique advantage with the Passport program, with our vertical specialization, with our limited partners to compete on something other than price.
And how did you connect with the Modern team? What is the common link there?
After I left Highbridge, I joined Starbest Partners, a B2B SaaS fund in New York, really two awesome women, was there for a few years and was actually on a board with Modern, with Constance. And so I'd gotten to know the team at Modern over those few years and then was presented the opportunity to join as a partner with Constance as we went on to start fundraising for her second fund. So joined a few years ago.
And is the whole team based in New York? Or I thought there was a Chicago office.
Right? Everyone's in Chicago except for me. Well, they all used to be in Chicago, I should say. No, I don't know where anyone, everyone is in the COVID nomad, as I say at this point. I don't know where anyone really is at this point.
Miami, Austin, LA, Boulder. That's where everyone.
Someone else is in Mexico as well on our team. So like, you know, really out there. But I've been in New York for my whole career. Three kids in school. I love Chicago, but had to stay in New York. And honestly, in a pre-COVID world, it was a really great benefit actually to be in New York and be in that ecosystem just from a deal sourcing perspective. So we basically saw it as a benefit. And I used to travel every week. That obviously has stopped. So I wouldn't mind getting on a plane every once in a while at this point.
Sure. And what is your take on the New York City venture ecosystem?
I mean, it's thriving. It's just pre-COVID, there were so many events, I couldn't even keep up with all the women in VC or women in all the New York events that were going on. So I think there's really a great ecosystem of early stage, seed stage. Obviously, there's a lot of later and growth stage people. I think it's a very, very vibrant ecosystem.
Is it easier to raise money now at a seed / pre Series A? Because I know there are a lot of funds that are kind of Series A plus. How about the seed and pre Series A level?
So what we really call ourselves, I say late seed to B minus is my usual tagline, which is sort of like those early Bs. Yeah. We can lead now. We're in the middle of fundraising, so I don't really want to talk about that per regulations. But I think for us personally, because our constituents are such huge companies, true seed is a little bit hard for us because the company really can't handle the LPs that we put them against when these huge, huge corporations. So in terms of the best time for us to be the most effective is in that sort of late seed to early B range. And we found fundraising from our strategics, obviously there was a bit of pause during COVID, but I've actually been surprised given how many issues that they're facing internally, how enthusiastically they've engaged with us.
And you guys invest both nationally and internationally, or is it just more on a national level?
It's really North America. I mean, we have one Canadian company. I often get things. Europe, I think on the prop tech sector is probably a couple steps behind the US. We do receive things, but as a small team, it's just hard to do things that are truly, truly international.
Right. And what's the average ticket size for you guys?
And with this new fund that we've raised in the middle of raising, it's $3 to $5 million.
Okay.
What is your view on the future of office work? I mean, are people going to continue to be remote? Do you think companies will go back to having an office? And obviously, you're looking at the market, but what do you think the trend is as somebody who looks at real estate?
I think that there's going to be a much wider range of different options than you used to see, just as traditional office work being the absolute norm. Pretty much everyone went in 5 days a week from certain hours of the day. And I think in the near term, certainly when there's safety is a big issue for people, you're going to see people definitely trying to space out how workers come back, because obviously no one wants to have any of their employees sick or be responsible for any of their employees sick. So for the near term, I think you're definitely going to see some cycling of people in and out of the office and making sure people are 6 feet apart and have proper safety protocols in effect so that people feel like they're safe at work, which is the first thing to get people back. I do think some companies will go back to the way they traditionally operated, depending on the industry, to a normal 9-to-5 workday. I've seen the more medical type industries, even the office staff and stuff that don't necessarily need to be there, that aren't actually the doctors, people are going back much, much faster than you see in other sectors. I think there is going to be a large part of the knowledge economy, the bankers, the VCs, the lawyers, that end up with more flexible schedules going forward in terms of the days that they're in the office. I think a real question for me too is how do things come back in terms of travel and conferencing and other things like that? I mean, I think it really remains to be seen. I think in 2021, people are going to be so hesitant to plan these type of events and business travel, you're not going to see a real trend towards those happening just because the planning time on all of those things is so long. So I'm actually interested to see how business travel comes back as well, to see if people decide Zoom is sufficient or if they want to meet face-to-face. We've done since COVID, I think I've invested in like 6 companies and never met people in person.
That is true.
Yeah.
And I think habits are going to change. And I think obviously some travel is going to come back in a big way once safety is reassured again. But I think a lot of meetings that were spur of the moment or without a lot of planning are going to be Zoom calls.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens with conferences as well and major events like South by Southwest and all of those in our industry.
I just don't think anyone knows what a fully vaccinated US even really means. I mean, are there strains that this is not going to work on? You know, all these other issues that are out there. So
yeah,
I just would doubt that people are really spending and planning before we know what our herd immunity looks like, that we're all wearing masks and still staying 6 feet apart or not, or if it's truly back to normal. I don't know.
Right.
Again, at this point, it's time for us to flip to our 4 specific questions that we ask of all of our guests in an attempt to get to know you better. So the first one is our NVCA question. The National Venture Capital Association advocates for public policy that supports the venture ecosystem and the entrepreneurial ecosystem in general. If there's one thing that you would change about the venture capital industry or one policy you would advocate for, what would it be?
Yeah, thank you. I mean, I think from a policy perspective, venture capital is a very, very important part of the U.S. economy and driving us forward as a technological leader. And I think anything that the administration can do from a tax perspective to encourage people investing in venture capital funds, to encourage more investment by venture capital funds, I think is really an important factor in sort of how the U.S. plays with the world. And we really are a very important part of the technological community and how innovation happens in the U.S. And fundamentally, overall, as the U.S. becomes more of a knowledge-based economy, the more important the things that we do as venture capitalists are.
Great. Our second question is, if you were not a VC investor and money was not a concern, what career would you have?
Well, when I was graduating from college, I always thought that I was going to be a professor. I was a mathematical economics major, and I had planned on being an econ professor until one of my roommates told me how much that investment banking thing paid. I didn't know what EBITDA what it was. Is it EBITDA? But I thought that it sounded pretty good. So I think I would have been a professor if I hadn't been lured into the world of investment banking. Now, I had originally thought an econ professor, but I truly would have been a history professor if I had my druthers.
That's great. Third question is, who is someone you look up to and why?
Well, I can tell you someone that my kids look up to a lot. So I have to admire him as well, who is Elon Musk, right? The guy is just an absolute Leonardo da Vinci of different industries. And they hang on his absolute every word, whether he's talking about Bitcoin or SpaceX or his Teslas or anything like that. And he's really an amazing character who's been successful in so many different arenas. I mean, I've got to admire the guy.
That's great. Definitely. Modern version of Thomas Edison.
It is, really, right?
And our final question, what is the best piece of advice you've ever received?
I think the best piece of advice I've ever received, at least in the venture capital industry, is sort of management, management, management. It really doesn't fundamentally matter if you have sometimes absolutely the best product, if you have absolutely the biggest market, if you don't have excellent, unbelievable management team, it really doesn't matter. And I have seen unbelievable management teams in smaller markets provide bigger exits than perhaps mediocre management teams in bigger markets. So really, fundamentally, for Modern and for me, the most important thing is vetting the management team and really believing that they have what it takes to make it, because it's a hard job.
For sure.
Well, Liza, thank you so much for joining us today. We really appreciated your time and the opportunity to learn more about you and Modern Ventures. So thank you again.
Thank you so much. Really enjoyed it.
And follow us on Twitter at ProofVC or on our website at proof.vc.